listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out what happened when a Wisconsin bar took down a wall and found an unexpected historical artifact. Now, an explosion a couple weeks ago at a missile testing site in Russia killed at least 7 people, and American intelligence officials reportedly think the source may have been a new kind of nuclear weapon. The Russian government's explanation about what happened has changed a few times since the explosion, but it comes as the U.S. is testing a missile that was off-limits under a recently abandoned treaty. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and an expert on international relations and nuclear weapons. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know so far about this explosion and what might have caused it?
Well, the current guess, essentially, we don't know for sure because the Russians are being very secretive about it. But the current speculation, informed speculation, is that it was a nuclear-powered missile, or at least the motor, the engine for a prototype nuclear-powered missile. And that may seem a bit strange because the United States has not been pursuing nuclear-powered missiles. We had a nuclear-powered missile program in the late 50s, early 60s, and went so far as to test it once or twice, but it never really got very far. For reasons that are pretty clear, given this recent explosion, we have nuclear-powered submarines, we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, we have nuclear power plants on land, one here in Wisconsin. But nuclear power plants are big and heavy and need a lot of shielding and protection and concrete and special rooms and lots of operators. And so to try to cram all that into something that would fly on a missile is extremely difficult and dangerous. And so we decided not to pursue that technology, but apparently the Russians have been pursuing it.
And so to make this distinction, when we think of a nuclear missile, we usually think of a conventionally driven missile with a nuclear warhead, the part that blows up. This is something that actually the motor, the thing that makes it move, would be nuclear powered.
Exactly. That's the distinction. Although in this case, the warhead itself might also be nuclear, but the key thing that makes this different and strange is the concept that it would be a nuclear-powered missile. Our missiles are powered by conventional rocket fuels, essentially, and everybody else's are too. It's the advantage. The reason why you might want to do it is because you would get extremely long range. Nuclear aircraft carriers can sail around the world for years at a time before they have to refuel. And so a nuclear-powered cruise missile could conceivably fly also around the world for days or even weeks at a time before landing on its target. And so that might give you some advantages if you want to have a missile that's sort of loitering off the enemy's coast and then strikes when you give it the command, something along those lines. But those advantages haven't been considered to be that great, given that we can already, with conventional ICBMs, conventionally powered ICBMs, hit anywhere in the world because they're just long enough range. And so you can fire it from the United States and 30 minutes later it will hit whatever target in Russia or China or wherever it would be. So we already have the ability to hit anywhere in the world. This would give you the ability to hit anywhere in the world with a cruise missile, which we have not had the capacity to do so far.
So that's on the Russian side of things. We also see in the news the U.S. Testing a range of missile, land-based missile, that would have been barred. We couldn't have tested it under a nuclear weapons treaty, a missile treaty that we just left in response to, I think the White House said, in response to Russia's actions.
Right. So we just tested a land-based cruise missile with a range somewhat over 500 kilometers. And those missiles were banned under a treaty known as the INF Treaty, or the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was negotiated and signed way back in 1987, when the United States and the Soviet Union were still engaged in the Cold War. And that was really a landmark treaty because it got rid of a whole class of nuclear missiles between 500 and 550, 5,500, sorry, kilometer range, both on the Russian side, the Soviet side, and on the American side, of the ground-launched variety. And all those missiles were destroyed, and the factories that made them were inspected so that we were sure that nobody was cheating on the treaty. It was the first time the Soviets allowed on-site inspections. So that was really a landmark treaty for the Cold War and helped really build the kind of trust that helped end the Cold War at that time. But since then, the United States has accused the Russians of violating that treaty by deploying and testing their own ground launch cruise missiles. And this recent test that we just conducted is our own. We have withdrawn from the treaty now, and so we are now testing such a missile as well. It's actually just a version of a missile we already had, the Tomahawk cruise missile that we launched from ships. But what's different about it and what would have been prohibited is the fact that it's being launched from ground, from land, rather than from a ship.
Why was this particular category of missile seen as so potentially destabilizing and risky?
Sure. The whole controversy or the whole crisis emerged when the Soviets started modernizing their intermediate range missiles. And the thing that was scary about those missiles is that they were based in the western portion of the Soviet Union and even in Eastern Europe. And they were very fast, the new versions that they were deploying in the late 70s and early 80s. They were very fast, and they could strike targets in Western Europe in 5-8 minutes with nuclear warheads, multiple nuclear warheads. And so they would essentially afford no warning time at all. So basically, the Soviets, if they wanted to start a war in a surprise attack, could be attacking German air bases or NATO air bases in West Germany or the Netherlands or even the UK, 5 to 10 minutes after deciding to do so. So that was deemed extremely scary and meant that we had to be on ever higher levels of alert so that we might be able to respond in time. But the more you are on higher levels of alert, the more chance there is for accidental war if there's some sort of glitch in the warning system. So that was viewed as extremely dangerous. And we wanted to negotiate those missiles out. The Soviets didn't want to give them up, so we deployed our own versions of those sorts of missiles. And then finally, both sides agreed to get rid of them altogether.
Talking to Andrew Kidd, expert on international relations and nuclear weapons at UW-Madison, looking at an explosion of what appears to be a nuclear-powered missile in Russia and a U.S. test of a missile that was recently banned from testing or unbanned because the U.S. withdrew from a treaty. Andrew, anybody who grew up in the, 1950s through 1980s, had this sort of, background dread of a nuclear confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. Then the 1990s came along, and I think we all got a sense that, okay, we're done with worrying about nuclear arms races anymore. Are we getting back to that point now?
We are getting back to that to some extent, with Russia to some extent, and also with China as well. We are modernizing our own forces. They are modernizing their forces. And I'm not so worried about the nuclear-powered cruise missile because I think that's essentially not ever going to work. But we're pursuing a lot of other technologies that might work and might lead to further rounds of escalation in the arms race. One of them is hypersonic weapons. So there's a new class of warheads, essentially, that are hypersonic. And ordinary ICBM warheads are hypersonic, meaning they go much faster than the speed of sound. Already, but they are not maneuverable. So you fire them, they go off through the atmosphere into outer space, and then they come back in on a predictable trajectory. And that's the whole basis of the American nuclear missile defense, national missile defense efforts to try to shoot down those warheads. But hypersonic warheads are also very much faster than the speed of sound, but they're maneuverable. They're sort of like little airplanes that are going incredibly fast. And so they can deliver warheads on targets at speeds associated with ICBMs, but they could come out of the blue, right? They're very hard to defend against. So the United States is pursuing that technology. China, Russia, all three are pursuing that technology. So that's a new round of the arms race that I think we're going to see becoming increasingly prominent in the next several years.
We had, during the Cold War, this long-running, sometimes on and off, regimen of negotiations and process with the Soviet Union and the United States. Do we have anything like that in place now with U.S., China, and Russia?
We don't really, and that's for a number of reasons. We did have a new effort at strategic arms control in the Obama years with the New START Treaty with Russia. That sort of continued this process of reducing the biggest ICBMs on each side, the United States and the Russian side. The Republican foreign policy establishment has never been that keen on arms control. And when Trump came in, there's sort of an interesting paradox there because Trump, of course, wants to improve relations with Russia. So you would think he would be in favor of arms control. But Trump himself also doesn't like international treaties, and that applies to arms control treaties as well. And he staffed his administration with hardliners, for the most part, and people like John Bolton, who are dead set against international treaties and international arms control treaties in particular. And so it's been very easy for Bolton and sort of anti-arms control folks in the administration to get Trump away from treaties, even though he's by and large, you know, sympathetic to the Russian perspective and wants to improve relations with Russia. So at the current moment, at least, arms control is dead in the water.
A system evolved during the Cold War of trying to communicate between the two sides and make sure, if at all possible, we did not stumble into a nuclear war unintentionally or through escalation. Do you know if we have that kind of back channel contact with China and Russia, even if we're not negotiating treaties, that, hey, we're keeping each other apprised and not backing into a nuclear confrontation?
Sure. There are still avenues of communication between the United States and China, the United States and Russia. And so those avenues are there. The question is, will they be used? Will they be trusted if push comes to shove? I don't see a huge issue with Russia right now, although there's a possibility. Largely the United States has withdrawn from Syria, which would have been a flashpoint because of the Russian forces in Syria. So we're sort of arms racing with Russia, but there's no obvious regional source of tension where we're sort of right up against each other. Whereas with China, there's still North and South Korea, where American forces are poised in South Korea, opposing North Korea. That's one flashpoint. And then there's the whole South China Sea area as well, where China is busily building up its presence in the South China Sea. And the United States is contesting that by sending our Navy in to conduct these freedom of navigation operations. And so that's another possible flashpoint between the United States and China.
And finally, just on a related note, getting back to Russia, President Trump has been talking about inviting Russia back into the Economic Group of Nations, currently the G7, making it the G8 again. Russia was ousted, in effect, for their occupation of, I think it was the part where they occupied Crimea. They're still there. What's the conversation on that right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting issue. I think that goes along with Trump's general sort of desire to improve relations with Russia in that regard, bring them back in to the fold and forgive them for various trespasses in the past. Interestingly, France seems to be on board with that. I'm not sure if it will happen. I think there's a lot of opposition to that on the part of the other countries in the G7. So we'll have to see. I think a lot of other countries are much less, are much more skeptical, let's say, of Putin and his intentions and motivations in joining and wanting to join such an organization. So I think that's going to be a bit contentious.
Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Andrew Kidd with UW-Madison's Political Science Department. He was with us today to talk about the state of nuclear weapons testing and international treaties, or lack thereof in some cases, after an explosion in Russia suspected to be from a prototype of a new kind of nuclear weapon, and concerns that we might be entering a new arms race. Coming up, we'll find out how a massive old circus poster has changed life at a family restaurant in Durand. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a sports writer says baseball games last an eternity, tennis matches take forever, and don't even get him started on golf. We'll look at why sporting events take so long and what could be done to pick up the pace. Now, when our next guest was working to renovate his family's bar and restaurant, he found something he couldn't have predicted, a massive mural of an ad for the circus. Turned out the poster was really old and in surprisingly good shape for its age. That was back in 2015. By 2018, local media were reporting on it. Lots of outlets from further and further away became interested in the story. Ron Berger lives in Durand, and the Corral Bar and Riverside Grill has been in his family for decades. He joins us now from Durand. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Yes. Yeah, it was an interesting thing. You talk about turning a life upside down. But, you know, it's still a good feel-good story, you know, versus the news. And, you know, we're getting kind of bombarded with things that aren't so pleasant. So it's still a feel-good story.
I think so, too. Now, describe what this poster looks like. Paint us a picture, if you can, of this really big circus ad.
Well, I guess he started out with what I used to, when I talked to a conservatory in Minneapolis and call up there and they asked what I found. Well, according to the historians, a 9-foot-tall, 55-foot-long, full-color, multi-sheet, woodblock-cut paper lithograph circus poster from 1885.
Wow.
And then you'd get silence.
55 feet long? Did you say that?
It actually went 60 feet long, where the 5 foot on the end was lost off in a saltwater aquarium piece, unfortunately, because that was a rare thing in the 1800s to have a mobile saltwater aquarium and a, you know, menagerie and circus type of train setting.
Now, your family had been working in this building for a long time. When you started to go at this wall, you had no idea this thing was down there, right?
Well, actually, we started out in 1977 with one building. My mom had purchased an old approximately 1816 stone building right off the Chippewa River in Durand. And in 1996, we purchased the building next door to it and added a restaurant, you know, and kitchen in. And then in 2013, I want to say, my sister, you know, 2008, my sisters bought my mom out, and then 2013 or so, bought that building next door, and it was a couple years of actually retailing. She renovated it for a kind of a secondhand store first, and our growth just got to where we could use it for a banquet room, and then the other, the secondhand store kind of, you know, I was competing with a St. Vincent de Paul's in town and stuff, and that was kind of a hard deal in a small town, so that didn't work out. We ended up, you know, having a room available to do, you know, banquet-style stuff. So my job was just to kind of put a doorway through a common wall of the buildings. There's two building walls, but where I cut in is a perfectly located buffalo piece charging at me when I opened up the lath and plaster, complete with snort coming out the nostrils. So it was kind of an interesting type of thing. But, you know, that wasn't so surprising. I think, you know, because the first take was, it was just a green kind of a paper that I seen the first place where I ended up cutting a buffalo's tail off. But it ended up being a grassy plain behind the buffalo. But it was the same color, so there wasn't no artwork on that right there when I initially pulled. But once I started pulling plaster off and lath, there, you know, it revealed a Native American riding behind the buffalo, and then the buffalo horn and the head and all that stuff. And then on the bottom, Russell and Morgan Printing Company, Cincinnati, Ohio, on the bottom. Well, then, you got to figure, oh, we've got something kind of odd here. And then to try to guess that the time period, it was kind of tough. You know, you just look at the, you know, it wasn't paint, you know, but it was a kind of a strange type of paper, and the artwork, it was kind of hard to figure out right away at first. We kind of first thought maybe a Buffalo Bill show, you know, a Wild West show when we first seen it, and thinking maybe it was just like a 6 by 6 foot maybe piece there. I think the more shocking thing was when we ended up taking the electrical box covers off on, you know, into the wall, and we shine light in there, and we seen this piece went the whole length of the wall. That was kind of like take your breath away. It's like, really, what the heck is they? What were they doing? You know, what is it? And the mystique, you know, for 5-6 weeks before I think that was on Labor Day weekend, and then it was October 13th before I actually pulled all that lath and plaster off to reveal what it was.
Now, this thing's knocking on the door of 150 years old. What kind of shape is it in?
According to historians, it's remarkable shape. This is a paper outside design billboard, you know, that was stamped, you know, in layered colors also. But it was, from everybody tells me that in the know, that it was made to last only like 2 to 3 weeks maybe outside. First rainstorm, it'd soak up moisture, the glue would release, and the fibrous paper would break down and just go into the ground, so they didn't have to send a team of people back to take them down after the show. So they're specifically, supposedly designed to weather away. So the anomaly is that it survived in the kind of shape that it is. It had to be the perfect storm where they were in a process of probably, I think I got enough evidence to support in the court of law that they're building, in the process of maybe working on the foundation of building a new building next door. And they seen where the river come right at Durand there. And that was becoming the world's greatest logging river, or was the world's greatest logging river in 1885. So they were wanting to advertise the river as well as townspeople, and the train come in 1882, a block or two away, and you just looked at the area, and everything was centrally located. The, you know, the hotels, the other businesses. It was actually a hardware store that they put the poster on. So I think they were working on this masonry front saloon when the circus advertisers come into town, and they seen the wall, and they kind of stopped them in their tracks and kind of, could you please wait till after the show to build this building? You know, could we use it? Because it's a perfect location. They probably threw tickets to both property owners. And after the show, they were gung-ho to put it up. And, you know, by the way, the show was August 17th, so a dry time of year generally. So the last part of July or first part of August, you probably had the perfect weather conditions, never got wet. And then they, you know, built the building over the top of it and laughed and plastered it up for 130-some years before I carved into it.
Ron, just a few moments left. If we stop by the Corral Bar, I mean, can we see this thing now? It's up where we can take a look at it?
Oh, absolutely. We got the room. Actually, you can go on even online to or look at our website and get in the menu section. We got some different links. The Smithsonian, you know, got some pictures. There's some news stories out there that's got pictures of it, but it's nothing. You got to see it in person if you can get by. We're getting people coming from, you know, Europe, Switzerland, Germany, Australia, China. I mean, we've had a lot of people travel from even outside the country as well as in the country, of course. They're all the same thing. They just kind of takes their breath away in the comments. They're just out of this world. You just can't imagine, you know. You know, it's just a time period. And I've kind of lost that freshness. And when I first, you know, opened it up and took it, you know, that head scratching, what year is this kind of thing, you know?
So, well, Ron, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us today. I'm going to be in Altoona for a listener event tomorrow night. Maybe I can swing out to Durand beforehand and give it a look.
Sure. There's one thing I'd like to get out there.
Real quick.
Look to the listeners. If they're coming just specifically to see that, it wouldn't be a bad idea if you're traveling the distance to call ahead to make sure we don't have a private party going on in there.
Oh, that's a good plan.
That's what it is. So I just want to make sure you got that point to everybody so they're not disappointed if they'd happen to travel just to see that. And
that's Ron Berger from the Corral Bar and Riverside Grill, site of a great circus poster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to a Wisconsin expert on insects for an up-close look at mosquitoes and the diseases they can carry, including West Nile virus. Tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when's the last time you watched a sporting event, pro or college, from start to finish? Been a while? Maybe it's because the games take so long. Consider this, the average Major League Baseball game in 2019 is 3 hours 8 minutes. Last year, a 60-minute National Football League game took an average of 3 hours 12 minutes to play. College football in 2016, 3 hours 24 minutes. And 18 holes of golf, that's at least 4 hours, and it's become a controversy on the Pro Tour. And while sporting events seem to be getting longer, our guest says our attention spans are getting shorter. So how do we get to this point? What can we do to pick up the pace? Jason Gay is a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks very much for having me. And I have 3 hours and 4 minutes to do this. So,
that's great. We'll take our
take
time.
Take our time.
Jason, this is your job. You write about sports. Do you have trouble making it through to the end of a game sometimes?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's like working in a coal mine, being a sports writer in 2019. I mean, look, I am very lucky to have this job, but I am not alone in the sports universe and feeling that games have become too prolonged, too inundated with commercials, timeouts. We have instant replay delays in virtually every sport, and we are pushing people away. When you talk about those lengths of games right now, you know, those are games are 20 to 25 to sometimes 40 minutes longer than what they were a generation ago. And so when people feel, boy, these games feel a lot longer than they used to when I was a kid, they're absolutely right. And partly that's a function of, yes, our attention spans are shortened. And, you know, there's no question that we have great many distractions right at our fingertips. But the games themselves have a responsibility to start accelerating the pace. A few of them, thankfully, are starting to do so.
We heard a counterpoint on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Roger, who says patience is required. Is this an us problem more than a problem with the sports?
I want to say it's mostly the sport. There's no question that patience, human patience, is just, I mean, look at us. You know, we have to have our food, our banking, our, you know, consumer buying done instantaneously and delivered immediately. We have become a very impatient society. But at the same time, these games have just overpadded the action with so many delays and distractions that they have just created these incredible time sucks. I mean, how many of us have started watching a game at 8 o'clock at night only to drift off to sleep in the fourth inning when it's 10 o'clock at night? That's not an acceptable situation. And especially when you're talking about a moment in which every sport is trying to, you know, get that next generation to make itself relevant to the people who are not going to be, you know, subscribing to cable TV. These are urgent issues for the sports themselves.
You mentioned commercials. How much of a factor is trying to cram in more revenue to take the taking the time to do it? How much of a factor is that?
It definitely is a factor. I mean, look, if you're a sports league and you are paying multi-billion dollars for packages of NFL and NBA games, and that's really what they are paying for these games, close to like $120 million for one episode of Monday Night Football, the burden is upon you to stuff it with as many sponsors as possible. Where you can get some relief is through agreement with the league. And the NFL actually realized it did have a problem, where it wanted to make sure that people weren't just checking out in the fourth quarter of games. And so it eliminated some of those gaps. The NBA doing the same with some of what we call the television timeout. It took me a long time in my NBA viewing career to realize that a television timeout is simply a commercial timeout. It's because they want to sell you a Mr. Coffee. It's not because the coach wants to tell the players anything. So they're trying to get rid of some of those interstitial delays. Some games are getting clever. You're seeing the kind of thing that you've seen in soccer forever, which is you'll have on-screen advertisements. We were rather late to the party here, but you'll see a game continuing while, you know, an advertisement trickles across the screen. There are ways to do this, and I think leagues are thankfully finally coming around to this.
Talking to Jason Gay, sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal, about sports and the games taking too long for people to stick with them. You mentioned soccer. We heard from John on Facebook who says, I watch soccer 90 minutes and it's over. You know, add a few minutes of extra time. I know exactly how long, John writes, the match will take. Is that, I mean, I've gotten into soccer mainly thanks to my kids. Is that giving us relief from sports fatigue?
I hear this all the time from people, that it is a compact viewing experience, that, you know, extra time here or there, you're pretty much out of there in 2 hours, okay, with halftime in the middle. It is a very compact viewing experience, that you can barely play five innings of a baseball game. You're only in the third quarter of a college football game. That is a real selling point for soccer in this country, both of the in-person experience and the person at home. You know, that's the other part we're not talking about. We're contextualizing this in terms of a television viewing experience with commercials and so on. But geez, if you're going to these games, if you're sitting in the ballpark and you're especially got to work tomorrow, or the kids got to go to school, these are factors that contribute to people's lack of interest or lack of motivation to go to games in the flesh.
Now, golf has a thing going on right now. Bryson DeChambeau has been criticized for taking a long time to line up shots. Brooks Koepka, a top-ranked golfer, says, I'm getting frustrated. Here he is on the Golf Monthly podcast earlier this year.
I just don't understand how it takes a minute and 20 seconds or a minute and 15 to hit a golf ball. It's not that hard.
He said the slow play is getting kind of embarrassing. Tell us what's going on here.
I mean, it's very unusual in golf for any golfer to call out another. So you know that they have to be very frustrated to make that kind of comment about each other. DeChambeau is a very, very slow player. He is a brilliant player. He's a really good player, but he's incredibly deliberate with lining up shots. There was a video going around a couple of weeks ago where it took him close to 3 minutes to line up a putt, which he then missed for comic relief. You know, golf is a sport that, look, this is, no one's ever going to confuse it with, you know, the UFC. It is a slow paced activity, but even in the participatory sphere, golf is struggling to get people in and around the course in a short amount of time. If you play golf, if you go to your regular golf course, most of them have a sign somewhere saying like 4 hour golf. That's our goal. You know, they want to get people in and around the course. That's a hard thing to do. It's shockingly hard, even with a cart sometimes. And you see all these kinds of variations. There's speed golf. There are shorter courses. Bigger holes is something people are experimenting with. But again, you know, that starts to verge up against what we were talking about at the beginning, are people changing themselves. And I do feel like golf as a participatory sport is something that might be suffering a little bit because, you know, people just don't have the downtime they once did. The idea of checking out in the morning, 9 a.m., saying, hey, going to play 36, see you later. It's just not happening in many people's lives anymore.
Now, for the big leagues, the NFLs and NBAs and what have you, they're still making a lot of money, right? Are they really, they might be thinking, okay, generationally this could be a problem, but do they feel a sense of urgency given that I think that the revenues are still coming in?
Well, you've honed in on a laser on really what is the hold up here, which is that this is a big business, and the business is selling commercial television properties. It is selling sponsorship opportunities to people from the networks. That is really what dictates how things happen. It dictates why games are on at 9:20 at night sometimes, which I think is just absurd. That is what drives this, because they are looking to max out the television audience, maximize the billions of dollars in revenue that they're making off of this kind of thing. And until they start to see some sort of tangible evidence that diminishing enthusiasm for the game is affecting that bottom line, I don't think you're going to see a great deal of hustling to make changes. I mean, consider baseball. I mean, people are complaining about baseball games being long for more than a decade now, and they are just proceeding along like sloths, like baseball sloths, very, very slowly.
That.
I mean, folks, who has not watched these endless visits to the bullpen, or these multiple trips to the relievers who are pitching to only one batter? It's getting ridiculous, and the game has changed, strategies have evolved, and I think it is affecting the bottom line.
We're talking about why sporting events take so long to play, what we could do to speed them up. Jason Gay is with us, sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal. I would definitely watch sloth baseball. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Do you think games take too long? Is it turning you away from a sport that maybe you used to watch, or keeping you from getting into one in the first place? Is there a change in your sport of choice that you'd like to see to fix it? Or is the problem with us? Maybe we should slow down, take the time, watch the commercials. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation on lengthy sporting events. A lot of people finding major sports taking too long. Maybe it's driving people away from watching them. Jason Gay is with us, sports columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Would you watch more sports than you do if it was less of a time commitment? Or are you happy to just set aside the time to watch the Brewers play, even if it goes into the 14th inning and what? Fourth hour, sixth hour, I can't remember what that was. Packer game in overtime. How much time can you devote to one sporting event in one sitting? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Stan is with us in West Allis. Stan, hi.
Yeah, real quick. I'll be real quick. Baseball, yeah, everything's statistics driven. That's all you hear throughout the game is statistics. Well, one of the statistics is the latter half of the ninth inning, if it's a home team in their head, that inning, half inning is not played. And statistics can be generated by people who want to make some impact on a team, but they don't get a chance to play either on the offense or the defensive side. Now, in football, two-minute drill or minute and a half left, and they're already congratulating each other because the game is over and one team's ahead one way or the other. It's a 60-minute game, and starting to get two minutes out of it. There's no impact. There's no play. Is that
Stan? Thanks a lot for the call. So Stan seeing wasted time in games, Jason.
Oh, absolutely. Football, there was a phenomenal story a couple of years ago in the Wall Street Journal. A colleague of mine wrote that they actually quantified how much action, from handoff to running back to quarterback, drop back, how much action was actually happening in an NFL game that lasts 3 hours, 4 hours? 11 minutes.
Wow.
11 minutes of actual action. Staggering, right?
That doesn't surprise me, because I cook often during football games. I bake. I make fridge pickles. We don't have a TV in the kitchen. I miss almost no action, and I accomplish a lot just in those moments where the action isn't happening.
I want to add something here, which is that I am a Wisconsin Badger, and I just want to put a caveat to everything that I'm saying, is that no Badger football or basketball games are ever boring. They're all incredibly electric, high-scoring affairs, and I've never been bored by a Wisconsin Badger game in my entire life.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Ed with us in Madison. Ed, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you think?
I just personally, I don't mind the time length of baseball games at all. I'm a Chicago Cubs fan. I grew up in Chicago, but I've lived in Madison for 25 years. And I just recently went to a Cubs-Brewers game in Milwaukee, and I paid like $65 a ticket. And just get in and out of the parking lot, I'm more than willing to watch a four-hour game as opposed to a two-and-a-half-hour game, because I just feel as if I'm getting more for my money.
Ed, thanks. So we're buying our time in bulk here, Jason. We want the longer game, he says.
That's interesting. And, you know, listen, you don't have to argue about the fact that tickets are expensive, and it's very expensive, especially you're talking about bringing a family to a game. And teams are adding all kinds of accoutrements and add-ons. You know, there are all kinds of fancy food offerings. Your choice of $14 beers if you want one. It really has become this heightened economic experience, and I can understand that. Maybe if you're going to spend all that money, you'd like to, you know, have it be a longer adventure.
Thanks for the call. Peter is with us now in Viroqua. Peter, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. So, not only is there the length of the game, but if you want to go to a game live, then there's driving there, there's parking, you get there early, there's waiting for the game to start, and then after the game is over, there's getting back to your car, getting back home.
Yeah.
So I maybe make it to a live game once a year, and then watching on TV, again, you know, if it's a 2.5 or 4 hour game or 3.5 hour football game, very seldom will I watch the whole game. What I do is I go to YouTube and I just catch the highlights, and then I'm seeing the best plays. And so that's my way around it, is taking advantage of the media and looking at it that way.
Peter, thanks for the call. Is this something that pro sports are scared about, people who just watch the highlights the next day and don't, you know, they maybe generate one bit of ad revenue, but they don't get that 3 hours of ad revenue out of that person?
No, nail on the head. They're really worried about it, because you have a situation where viewers at home feel they're not going to miss things. Forget about YouTube. There are any number of social media channels where they're able to catch highlights. It can be instantaneous now. Somebody says, oh, the Brewers just hit a home run. You can look it up on Twitter and find it in 3 seconds. There's a whole belief now that the generation is coming of age that they're not going to watch games in a linear fashion that you or I might do. You know, we're not watching the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter. They'll be kind of coming in and out. They'll watch multiple things at once. That's a distracted kind of viewer. That's not a greatly attractive viewer to an advertiser. So that does spell trouble unless they're figuring out a way to make it more captive.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jason, in our last few moments, is there a league that you see being more aggressive about this and really taking steps to make it more of a manageable package?
You know, it's funny. You look at a sport that's growing, right? It's the Ultimate Fighting Championship. And I don't believe that this is everybody's cup of tea. It is a very aggressive sport. It is a bloody sport. However, matches, even at the championship level, do not last longer than 15 minutes. And there's packs and packs of them every night. You have, you know, a great deal of entertainment for people. If you don't like that one, there's another one that comes after it. They have drilled into, obviously, there's a primal, you know, a fascination with fighting, which is undeniable. But they've also drilled into this idea now that people want a lot. They want a lot of stimulation. They want a lot of different fights. I'm not saying that, you know, we should institute brawls now in all baseball games. But if, you know, they kept it to 2 minutes, or, you know, maybe we get something out of that.
A chilling vision of things to come. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's Jason Gay, sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal. We talked with him about why he says sports often take too long, and it's time maybe to pick up the pace. You can keep sharing your thoughts at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is there a sport that you still like, even though it's pretty long? Or do you have ideas to make your favorite sport shorter? Let us know or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a very unique kayak race.
Paddle Quest is part scavenger hunt, part fantasy role-playing game, and part Mardi Gras. Every August, hundreds of people converge on the backwaters of the Wisconsin River flowage in Stevens Point. Participants paddle from place to place, playing games and interacting with wizards and pirates, sirens and time travelers. Rob Mentzer was there for Paddle Quest's 18th year.
No one really understands it. But I kind of write it out and I kind of make sense of it. My name is Matt Kirsch, and I am the creator of Paddle Quest.
All right, questers, looking out at a very glassy Wisconsin River flowage. That is nice.
So the way Paddle Quest works is teams start from Lakeside Bar, and they paddle to different camps all along the river where the characters have stations set up that you compete in various challenges.
All right, we're gonna throw in two.
What's the point of this? Why do this?
To take a break from the monotonous reality of the normal day.
Well said, man.
To explore the backwaters with your best friends.
Raddest camaraderie around.
All right. People bring a lot of creativity to this event. People dress up as characters, like a league of their own. They're champions. They were the first all-female team to win.
I'm Chamomile Nuss.
Deanna Linsmeyer.
Katie Butke.
It was about being a league of their own.
Yeah, the name really
we're
rang
really
true through us.
Is
yeah.
Basically what's happening.
You guys ready to sing the paddle song?
My paddle's keen and bright, flashing with silver, follow the wind, dip, dip, and swing.
Woo! Heck yeah! Perfect score this year! That's a
My name is Ellie Jackson. There are three challenges at Siren Island. One of them is Can Jam. One person throws a frisbee and one person sort of slams the frisbee into this, like, can. But it's a team sport, and if there are two teams, yeah, they got one. It's a hard feat. Our whole goal is to keep people here forever.
Miranda Krasinski.
Brody Bruner.
And we are the...
Anomalies.
Yes, the Anomalies.
We came up with that team name 4 minutes before we registered. So
yeah.
We are on Bear Island. They've got a nice mix-up of dice and blackjack for us. Where you try to roll a bunch of dice, try to get as close to 21 without busting.
Did you pass this before? Oh, yeah, because...
Yeah, the sign.
I didn't remember seeing that.
Okay, so what happened was we clearly made a wrong turn, and we ended up at Bear Island. So we made a giant circle in the wrong direction. We had lost our canoe. It was very bad.
Oh, my God, these mosquitoes. They're just, look at them around me. They want my blood.
We somehow ended up back at the Bear Island event, at which point one of the Bear Island folks guided us back to our canoe ever so kindly.
Is that Bear Island?
And choose wisely!
Choose wisely.
Because it's so community-based and so many people come out to help me with this, all the characters and stuff, that I get kind of weepy when I think about it. Because it's just so moving that people just are come together so well.
This is like my favorite weekend of the entire year. I love to paddle. I love to play games. I love to compete. And I love to hang out with my friends.
You get so stuck in adulting, and to come to something like this, and you can, it's like summer camp. It's magic.
Totally. It's magical.
Ah!
What makes some people mad? Make a living questing.
Those were the sounds and characters from Paddle Quest in Stevens Point. WPR's Rob Mentzer was not crowned protector of the backwaters, but he did bring us that story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a big group of business leaders say they're changing their corporate philosophy to say there's more to life than creating value for shareholders. We'll look at the new statement and ask if it's a big change or just window dressing. Plus, a music writer went on a quest to find the first ever hip-hop song created in Milwaukee. We'll check out the detective story and explore a unique piece of Wisconsin's music history. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.